Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I want to thank everyone who came out to the Mothman Festival and to the Light in the Dark tour. It was such a pleasure to meet you guys. There's going to be a special episode next week, and I'll get into all the details, all the stories of what happened on the tour. It was so fun. We had a great time. Susan and I survived. We're back home now. We're still a happily married couple. So I say it was a success. But anyway, yeah, I'll tell you all the stories on an episode that I'm going to drop next week. Special bonus episode. And what else? We don't have too much more to say. Oh, some of you were wondering who is doing the voice of the National Directory of Haunted Places. Okay, that is my friend, Brian Edward Hill, the great Brian Edward Hill. He and I met on Titans. He was a Titans writer, as was I. We were there all 4 years, and we had a lot of fun. We became good friends. And so I asked him, hey, would you mind lending your Darth Vader-like voice to this? Can you give it that sort of Vincent Price funk of 40,000 years thriller video kind of? And he was like, oh, yeah, I got it. So anyway, Brian Edward Hill is the guy doing the voice of the National Directory of Haunted Places. And last thing, oh, new thing on Patreon. If you're not on Patreon yet, you might want to consider joining at the Obsessed Fan level. I am now giving you behind the curtain access, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it. I'm now recording myself doing the episodes, doing the recordings, okay? Just on my little photo booth app that I've had since, you know, computers began. But anyway, if you want to see me recording the episodes, including the mistakes, including everything, I don't edit these. It's just, I turn the camera on, I record the episodes. If I screw up, I do it again. And if you want to see it, if you need a visual component to this podcast, right now, this is what you got. So join Patreon at the Obsessed Fan level, and you can watch me read. Okay, there you go. That's it. I'm happy to be home. So glad to be sitting down with you guys again. On with the show. Here we go. The National Directory of Haunted Places by Dennis William Houck, Part 2. All we knew about the baby, who was heading toward our lives like a runaway train, was that he was going to be a boy and his name was going to be Owen. We figured he'd let us know anything else important about himself once he got here. The name Owen came from a book we both loved, A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, William Morrow, 1989. Beyond naming him, I didn't really put anything on him, if you know what I mean. I didn't spend time fantasizing about playing catch with him or taking him fishing or watching basketball or coaching soccer or really nothing sports related. But I didn't even fantasize about showing him Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time, or for that matter, the A-Team. I didn't have any expectations about his childhood at all, except for one thing. While it was happening, his dad could not be a complete failure. The idea that he'd grow up seeing me as a guy who had a dream but never achieved it, that was terrifying to me. I wanted to be a living example of how dreams come true. I wanted him to believe in something and believe in himself. And to be completely honest, I guess I did want him to believe in one more thing. I wanted him to believe in ghosts.
Coldwater, Michigan, Halstead House. This painted lady Victorian home is haunted by the ghosts of two children who sit at the top of the maid's stairway. The Italianate house with a central cupola tower was built in the 1870s by Lorenzo Halstead, a New Yorker who set up a sewing business in the area. Nothing else is known of the children, how they died, or why they have chosen to appear in this particular spot.
Michelle and I arrived in Ann Arbor, Michigan on Saturday, May 4th, 1996. And the very next day, we drove out to Coldwater to see the haunted Halstead House. It was only a 90-minute drive outside of Ann Arbor. Plus, we'd never been to Michigan before, and we figured this was a good way to see some of it. So after a breakfast of fried eggs, bacon, and strawberry waffles, we hit the open road. And let me tell you, May in Michigan looks like January in Michigan. At least it did that year. There was still snow on the ground. Spring had not yet sprung. But it didn't matter. The bleak landscape was absolutely intoxicating to me. I was floating on a cloud of optimism and hope and excitement because, among other things, I was about to see my first legitimately haunted location. You heard me right. I was 29, and to my knowledge, I had never been anywhere that was haunted. Michelle had a large paper folding map open on her already crowded belly, and she happily directed me. It was a pretty easy route, 84 miles in only two turns. Interstate 94 west to the 69 south, and then take the Chicago Street exit west. We rolled up on the Halstead House. It looked disappointingly normal, sitting right there in the middle of the block with garbage cans out front, an overgrown lawn, and the whole thing in need of a paint job. But the thing that really got my attention was the sign in the front yard that said, "For sale." Why not, I thought. Why not buy this house? Why not live in Michigan? This house would be way cheaper than anything I could afford in Los Angeles. Plus, it would be haunted. I would own a haunted house. It's like I would own a ghost. Or in this case, two ghosts. The dead kids at the top of the stairs. Someone for Owen to play with. And so what if we had no savings, no down payment, and that we were now well over $50,000 in debt? The fantasy of buying a haunted house made perfect sense to me. Because after my phone call with Wayne Williams just three nights ago, anything and everything seemed possible. After 6 months of desperately trying to line up my first solo writing gig and failing, I was actually going to be pitching the A-Team movie to Stephen J. Cannell himself. The very thought that I might be in a room with him again after 13 years made every other thing in my life click into place and make sense. This was the thing I'd been waiting for. It was just too perfect. There was no way I wasn't landing this job. You see, I had met Stephen J. Cannell once before when I was a junior in high school and had just started writing. I was 16 years old at the time, and his show The A-Team set fire to something inside my brain. For the first time, I understood that everything on TV that I loved was written by someone. And the only thing that could possibly feel better than watching something I loved would be writing that thing. Once that connection was made, it was like an electric current lit up my soul in blazing green and red neon. I had all this undirected energy coursing through my body for years, and now, suddenly, it had a direction and a focus. I spent all my high school afternoons in the spring of 1983 writing my own episode of The A-Team, the first TV script I ever wrote. I knew deep down this was the beginning of a lifelong journey. This was the first step on a road to becoming who I was supposed to be. I spent 6 months trying to get my script to Stephen J. Cannell himself. Surely he would recognize my talent, my deep soul-level connection to the characters he had created. He would know if I could just be in his presence for a minute and hand him my script, that I was the guy. Now, I did manage to hand him my script, and the story of that meeting is told in episodes 207 and 208 of this podcast. And I definitely recommend, if you haven't heard those episodes, that you pause right here, go listen to them, and then come on back and continue listening. In fact, while you're at it, listen to all the episodes you might have missed, and then follow, subscribe, rate, and review, and check us out on YouTube. And you know what? Become a Patreon subscriber, and then tell a couple of your friends about the show, and then come back and continue listening to this episode. Anyway, I couldn't get over how strange it was that this particular opportunity was coming up at this particular time. The two projects that I pursued over the last 5 months had a lot to recommend them. They were big action movies, and I worked hard on the pitches. But Michelle had been the first to point out that none of them felt like me. And now suddenly this, a movie version of the TV show that made me want to write TV and movies in the first place. I mean, how much more me could it get? In fact, it was also perfectly and overwhelmingly me that I started to think, maybe it's too perfect, too personal. Maybe I was poised to blow it. After all, it hadn't gone according to plan 13 years ago. Why was I so sure it would go better now? Because it had to, that's why. For me, for my future, for Owen, I needed to sink an impossible Hail Mary shot to cement my faith in the weird, wild, synchronistic, supernatural beauty of the world. A world where anything was possible and anything could happen.
Tollgate, Blue Mountains, Oregon. Researchers tracked a group of four Sasquatch monsters in this area from 1982 to 1987. Their footprints ranged in size from 16 to 18 inches. The first footprints were found near Elk Wallow in 1982. In 1986, three different sets of tracks started appearing. These included a set of 12-inch footprints thought to belong to a young Bigfoot. A supposed sleeping lair was discovered, as well as significant damage to shrubs and trees. Different footprints were discovered near Tollgate in 1986, and the sighting occurred in a road about 20 miles to the north of the resort town.
As soon as we got back to Los Angeles from Michigan, things started moving fast. I had lunch with Wayne Williams, the head of Stephen J. Cannell's motion picture development team. I found him waiting for me at a back table inside a very dark wood-paneled, red leather-boothed restaurant on Ventura Boulevard called Casa Vega. Wayne was a grinning, gimlet-eyed man bursting with energy. He stood about 5'5", tall for a Hollywood elf. Everything Wayne said was in italics, like this. For this pitch to work, and it will work, you have to accept certain givens. Rules, not rules, givens. Was this guy for real? Or was this George Peppard in an elaborate disguise? Was this some kind of a test? Was I actually in an episode of the A-Team? In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. First given, it's gotta be modern day. The characters can't be Vietnam vets. It's 1996, so they gotta be veterans of the Gulf War. You know the Gulf War? I told them I'd heard about it. It was in all the papers. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Second given, we must see exactly how they meet, how they come together as a team, why they're arrested, and how they eventually escape from military custody. The second given was really four givens, but who's counting? Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. Third given, and this is the most important given, the rest of the movie has to be their first job. Because this isn't just a movie, Richard. We're launching a franchise. He leaned in on the last given so that the significance would not be lost on me. I'm no genius, but I had kind of assumed all of these givens within about 10 seconds of hearing that they wanted to make an A-team movie. But hey, at least we were all on the same page. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-team. Well, I definitely had a problem. I was broke, in debt, and I needed a job. And yeah, no one else could help. I was going to have to do this one on my own. No Matt Reeves helping me this time. Now the only question was, could I find the A-team? To be honest, I hadn't thought about the A-team a lot in the last 13 years. After our whirlwind fling in 1983, the romance had cooled. I kept watching the show, but after season 3, I moved on. We just grew apart. But you never forget your first love. Could I rekindle the flame? Could I find the A-team? I thought I could. Something told me I was good for one more ride in the black GMC van with the blood-red stripe, for old time's sake. The lunch rolled on. Wayne insisted on margaritas. Now, I made it a rule not to drink at business lunches, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. And the ones he ordered, with a knowing wink to the waiter, were dark green and served in tall glasses and were obviously not on the menu. Wayne told me everything he knew about what this movie needed to be. Everything he knew about Stephen Cannell. What he liked, what he hated, what made him laugh. What exact phrases I should use to trigger the stories he loved to tell. Everything he could possibly tell me to get me this job. I'd never had a meeting quite like it. I felt enchanted, hypnotized. There was something magical about Wayne, something Yoda-like, something not quite terrestrial. He kept saying, "Trust me. Will you trust me, Richard? You have to trust me." I drained another one of those strange margaritas. Was he even drinking them, or was it just me? Were they even margaritas? I trust you, Wayne. God help me, I trust you. What choice have I got?
Fisher House, Wausau, Wisconsin. During the 1970s, a modern house here was the site of considerable poltergeist activity. Harry and Jackie Fisher moved into their split-level home in 1972. Almost immediately, they noticed a ringing sound, like a tiny bell, that drifted through the house. Their pots and pans seemed to move by themselves, even inside the cupboards, and small objects floated in the air. In 1973, they started hearing footsteps scurrying through the halls, and later, the sounds of tribal drumming filled the house. By 1975, the unbelievable activity had increased to the point that knives and straight razors were being hurled at the family. They finally decided to share their experiences with their pastor, who blessed the house. When that did not work, they sold the house to Jim and Mary Strasser. The Strassers thought the ghost stories the Fishers told them were just figments of the couple's imagination, until they, too, became the targets of the unfriendly presence. One night, Jim Strasser had a terrible nightmare about an old Indian wrapped in a blanket and suffocating. Investigators later discovered that the house was built directly on top of an old Indian burial ground.
The pitch to Stephen J. Cannell was scheduled for Wednesday, May 22nd, less than 3 weeks away. Meanwhile, David Saunders kept sending me material for other jobs, scripts that needed to be rewritten and books that studios wanted to adapt, but I pushed them all aside, canceling meetings and postponing phone calls. David did not like this. It made him nervous. As far as he was concerned, the A-team pitch was just another job, no better or worse than the others. In fact, probably worse, because getting the job was such a huge long shot. I mean, what were the odds that Universal would trust a young, untested solo writer with what was surely going to be a huge budget summer tentpole movie. But with each passing day, for me, it became the only job, the only one that mattered. This was not a professional attitude, or even remotely realistic. I was being irrational. The search for any job in Hollywood is like playing roulette. You want to have more than one chip on the table. But for some reason, I just kept stacking all my chips on one spot. Black 22, May 22nd. For 2 weeks, Wayne was my only guide as we built the pitch. And strangely, instead of getting more nervous as the date approached, I got more calm. I achieved some sort of weird, elevated Zen state, my mind and body and soul existing in the eye of an enormous hurricane, keeping me temporarily safe from any thoughts of failure. And then something happened. On May 21st, Michelle began having strange pains along the sides of her abdomen. After a tense examination, her OBGYN, Dr. Franklin, informed us that she was in early labor. It was only week 33 of her pregnancy. Now, it wasn't catastrophic, but it was alarming. He wanted to make sure that she didn't give birth until at least week 35, at the absolute earliest. So he admitted her to the hospital and began treating her with something called tocolytics, which were supposed to stop contractions. He said she'd be there at least one night, maybe two. They wanted to keep an eye on her. So I went home that night alone. I tried to read the National Directory of Haunted Places, but for the first time, I couldn't. My eyes kept sliding off the page. The words wouldn't connect. Owen might be born prematurely. There might be complications. For some reason, this was the last thing I expected. My preoccupation with finding work consumed all of my free-floating anxiety. I never really stopped to think that trouble could come from another direction. Dr. Franklin assured us that we were still on track to have a healthy baby and that the hospital's neonatal unit was set up precisely for this sort of thing. The expectation was that the drugs they were giving Michelle would delay contractions and that for every week we could keep her from giving birth, the better the outcome would be, primarily in terms of birth weight and lung development. In other words, they were on it. But still, we were in uncharted territory now. Anything could happen. Michelle seemed fairly unfazed, but for me, a door had opened, and the door was marked reality, and I had worked so hard to keep it closed. Not just recently, but for much of my life. Reality was the thing that told me in harsh tones that my chances of succeeding in my chosen career were nil, and that I'd better have a plan B ready to go. Maybe two or three of them, and a plan C just in case. And of course, I had none of these. Reality crossed its arms and shook its head while reminding me that I was bankrupting my family and setting us up for financial ruin by assuming a miracle job would arrive out of nowhere and save us in a single stroke. Reality whispered that I hadn't solved my mom's depression, and I wouldn't solve Michelle's either, no matter what happened with my career. And it wasn't like a baby would help the situation either. So I pushed reality back into its closet and slammed the door and leaned against it with all my weight. I managed to keep it shut, but I could hear the doorknob rattling and the muffled voices inside, just behind me, demanding to be heard.
Grand Rapids, Michigan. The Bell Telephone Company. This modern technical center is haunted by the ghosts of Warren and Virginia Randall, whose house once stood on the property. The young couple moved into the house in 1907. They seemed happy until Warren lost a leg in an accident at work on the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad. Fitted with an artificial leg, he became depressed and insanely jealous of Virginia. During one of their many arguments, Warren took off his leg and beat his wife to death with it. Then he opened the gas jets and slashed his own throat. It was 2 weeks before the police found their horribly decomposed bodies. the house quickly gained a reputation for being haunted, and nobody would live in it because of the couple's ghosts. It was finally torn down in the 1920s when the telephone company built a brick office on the site. The Randalls' ghosts have been blamed for numerous unexplained events in the building, as well as strange phone calls made late night to Michigan Bell customers.
My first thought upon waking up the next morning was, there were no phone calls in the middle of the night, which meant that nothing scary had happened in the past 7 hours. Michelle was still pregnant. Owen was still on the inside. But of course, that could change any second. My next thought was, my pitch is today. I'm going back to Stephen J. Cannell's office for the first time in 13 years. In a few hours, it'll all be over. Good or bad, I'll know today. Then the phone rang. I went to answer it, expecting it to be Michelle. But the machine picked it up first, and I heard the voice of a man telling me he was a representative of Washington Mutual Bank, and he needed me to call him back about arranging payment of my debt. He had the unlikely name Randy Press, and his accent wasn't immediately recognizable to me. Maryland? Kansas? Hell? He left what seemed like a personal phone number, not a 1-800 number. I was intrigued and terrified, so I called him back immediately.
Yes, Mr. Haddam, thank you for calling me back. This is regarding the debt on your Washington Mutual Bank Visa card. You have committed in writing to pay a minimum monthly fee, but you have failed to do that for the past 2 months.
See what I mean about his accent? It kept sliding around, never stopping anywhere too long, always on the move. I said, hey, I'm really sorry, but yeah, I will be paying that, whatever the amount is, on the next bill.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Haddam, he said, but we're going to need to arrange payment today.
There was something bracing, almost refreshing, in the directness of our conversation. His voice sounded 6.5 feet tall, with a strangely wrinkled face and a broken nose, and extremely large hands, a lantern jaw, like Rondo Hatton. His voice was wearing a shapeless black fedora and a black raincoat. He didn't want to work with me. He wanted me to work with him. He asked me if there was any way I could get the money today. Then he asked me if there was someone I could borrow it from. I think that's what did it. All of my anxiety and fear and insecurity and anger rose up inside of me, and I embraced it, which was the last thing I expected. Suddenly, I was grinning past a cigar clenched in my jaw. BA was standing to my left, scowling, arms crossed over his massive chest. Faceman smiled as his hand drifted toward the gun concealed inside his $1,000 sport coat. And Murdoch paced back and forth, his head cocked like a pigeon, his eyes tracking Randy with sharp, avian interest. I said, gee, I don't have anyone I can borrow the money from, Randy. If I did, I guess I would have done that already.
Mr. Haddam, he said, you seem to have some skill at transferring debt to new credit cards. That would be perfectly sufficient in this case, but I'm going to need you to do that today.
Since he was being so straightforward and honest, I decided I would too. Look, Mr. Press, I said, I know you're just doing your job, but my wife is pregnant and on total bed rest, and I have a big pitch coming up today, maybe the biggest pitch of my life. If it goes well, I'll have more than enough money to pay Washington Mutual back, but right now, that's the only place any money is coming from. There is no other place. So let's you and I cross our fingers and hope they love it, and that my agent can go after them for a real payday, okay? I was having fun. Nothing to lose fun. Beyond fear fun. How much worse can things possibly get fun? On the Jazz Fund. Randy was unimpressed. He told me again how important it was for me to get my debt settled this week and told me to think about various ways in which I might accomplish this and reassured me that he would be calling me again tomorrow. But I was no longer afraid of Randy. Today had turned into this week awfully fucking fast. The minute the connection was cut, the adrenaline in my blood surged and then dropped, leaving me nauseous and weak. Of course Randy was right. Of course I owed them money. Just needed a little more time. I drove straight to the hospital. Michelle was sitting up, eating Jell-O and drinking chicken broth, the only things she was allowed. She told me they were planning to keep her there one more night, and then when she came back home, she'd have to continue being on bed rest for at least 2 weeks. Dr. Franklin walked in and cheerfully announced that we were going to be parents sooner than we'd planned. Late June, most likely, rather than early July. Finally, when it was time for me to go, I said goodbye to Michelle and drove to Hollywood. At least I knew that for the next few hours, she would be well taken care of and nothing scary would happen. 20 minutes later, I was at the building with Stephen J. Cannell's name on the top. The last time I was here, it was 1983. I sat in the car for a minute. So much had happened since then. USC Film School, and Michelle being away at Yale for 4 years, breakups and reunions, and finally getting married. Writing Dark Territory, and selling it, and getting it made. Struggling through scripts that just didn't work. Until one finally did. Truth or Consequences. And then it didn't sell. But it did lead to this meeting. So here I was again, pitching to Stephen J. Cannell. Only this time, I was a semi-successful writer. They, of course, had no idea who I was, or that I'd ever been here before. They didn't know I was the guy that conned his way into their offices all those years ago. And I was glad, because I wanted to be seen as a real writer. This wasn't a gag or a stunt. This time, I was dead serious.
KDKA TV station, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This modern television studio is haunted by the ghost of its former facilities director, Julian Draub. He died in May 1963 of a sudden heart attack at the age of 50. He apparently left behind a lot of unfinished projects because his presence lingered on to help those out who took over his work. Late at night, the lights would go on in his old office, and two reporters witnessed papers turning over one by one on the top of his desk. Others felt his perfectionist spirit guiding them in the daily operation of the station.
I went up to Wayne's office on the second floor. As usual, he was amped. His energy level was in the fucking stratosphere. He took one look at me and zeroed in. "What's wrong? You look upset. Are you okay?" I had specifically planned to say nothing at all about what was going on with Michelle. But then, before I knew it, I was telling Wayne everything. Michelle's abdominal pains, the early labor, the medicine she was on, the hospital stay, the bed rest, the eventual premature birth our doctor more or less guaranteed. Everything. And he was thrilled. "Oh my God. Oh my God," he kept saying. "This is amazing. You gotta tell Stephen." "I don't know," I said. I didn't want to muddy the waters. I wanted to keep things professional. "No," he said. "You gotta tell him. Trust me." He ran across his office and started rummaging through what looked like an enormous gift basket. Then he came back with an oddly shaped bottle that had a small piece of rope tied around its middle. He held it up. "You like Frangelico? You need a drink." He had never had Frangelico at the time, didn't even really know what it was. Why was Wayne always giving me things to drink? He opened the bottle, then grabbed two coffee mugs off of his desk and filled them both halfway with the thick brown liquid.
I took a sip. It was sweet and dark and tasted like hazelnuts. The first sip was shocking, but the second went down smoother. We kept talking about how crazy it was that all this was happening, today of all days. And he kept telling me that I absolutely had to tell Stephen everything as soon as we got in the room. I still wasn't sure about that, or why he felt it was so important. But as I got to the bottom of my mug and Wayne refilled it, I was starting to like the idea better and better. The phone on Wayne's desk buzzed, and he picked it up and said, "Okay, Richard and I are coming up." Oh boy, it was time. I was feeling warm and fuzzy and weirdly emotional. I wasn't sure if this was the best frame of mind for the most important pitch of my life. I was so far off the beaten path. Between Michelle and the early labor and now Wayne and the Frangelico, events had overtaken me and I had let them. I felt like I was no longer in control of the situation. I'd wandered too far into the woods. The sun was setting and the wind was howling, and yellow eyes tracked me as I stumbled further and further away from any marked road. I went to set down my mug and Wayne practically shrieked, "No! Bring it with you! Trust me!" He grabbed the bottle and darted out of the office. I followed. On the elevator ride up to the top floor, I tried to remember if it looked the same as it did 13 years ago. It was hard to tell. It was the inside of an elevator, and I was buzzed. And I was also trying to remember the funny thing I wanted Hannibal to say in the first scene. It was floating around in my mind somewhere. I just couldn't quite reel it in. Maybe it would just magically land on my tongue when I needed it. The elevator doors opened, and I looked to my right immediately. There was no longer a desk in the wide hallway, no low couch where Larry and I had sat waiting. Nothing about the carpeting or the walls looked familiar, and it all looked smaller than I remembered. But the twin oak doors were still there, and Wayne headed right for them. "I can't fucking believe this," I thought. "I'm gonna walk through those same doors, through those same offices. It's a replay, a repeat, a redo, a second chance." Then Wayne walked past the oak doors and on down the hallway, and for the first time, I felt a real stab of cold fear. Where were we going? This wasn't right. We're supposed to go through those same doors, the oak doors. But Wayne kept walking, and the hallway began to curve, revealing new vistas of doors, one after the other, and my knees and ankles felt spongy and weak, and my peripheral vision clouded over until all I could see was a narrow channel right in front of my eyes. And then Wayne chose a door at random and opened it, and I walked in, and Stephen J. Cannell was standing there staring at me. Now, if you've never met Stephen J. Cannell, he's approximately 9 feet tall. Or at least, that's how tall he looked that day. He stared at us, surprised, and then he saw the bottle in Wayne's hand and looked even more surprised. "Hey, what kind of pitch is this?" he said. Wayne said, "Stephen, you're never going to believe this. Wait till you hear what Richard's been through." That was my cue. Before I knew it, I was telling Stephen Cannell a story. And just like that, I'm over the falls. No awkward buildup, no lame conversation about the weather or how my drive-in was. I'm pitching the exciting story of Michelle's premature labor, and Stephen J. Cannell is hanging on my every word. I even managed to work in that Michelle was my high school sweetheart, to which Stephen Cannell said, "Hey, I married my high school sweetheart, too." And in my mind, I think, "I know you did. That's why I mentioned it. I know everything about you. I've been stalking you for years." We chat like old friends, and we wander from the outer office into the inner office, and it's got a big couch and chairs and a coffee table. It's just like every other office I've ever pitched in, except much larger and much more nicely decorated. I casually slip into my actual pitch, my A-team pitch, which, like all of my pitches, starts with a personal story about my connection to the material and how much it means to me and why I'm the only guy in the world who could possibly write it. Now I know what you're thinking. Now would be an absolutely amazing time for me to reveal that he and I have actually met before. But I don't do that. Like I said, I want to be seen as a professional writer, not some psychopath. I decided days ago to keep that story to myself. I'll tell it to Steven when he and I are sitting next to each other at the premiere of the A-Team movie, years from now in the indistinct future. Instead, I simply tell him what a fan I am of the show and exactly why I'm a fan, and what it is I love about the show so much, and specifically what it is about the character of Colonel John Hannibal Smith that has always appealed to me. Hannibal never seemed to be afraid of anything, and he had a sense of the theatrical. For him, it wasn't enough just to defeat the bad guys. It had to be done with style. I told Stephen Cannell how I'd been plagued by fear of just about everything for just about my entire life. I told him how I used to spend my time in class trying to come up with my own adventures for the A-Team because the reality of high school, boredom, loneliness, crushing insecurity, was all too much to bear. Reality had to be held in check, had to be kept in place. This was for my own survival. So it was characters that he created, like Hannibal Smith and before that, Jim Rockford, that gave me an ideal of courage to aspire to, even if wanting to literally be them was not entirely realistic. These characters were never about empty tough guy bluster, but instead they displayed real courage and stood side by side with wit and a sense of irony and even self-deprecation. That's what appealed to me. That's what I loved. And that's why I was here today. Cannell was smiling and slowly nodding his head in agreement. This wasn't an attempt to flatter him, not really. This was the God's honest truth. And if I didn't get it out, get it stated right up front, nothing I said after was going to make any sense. He had to understand exactly where I was coming from. So once I had set the scene, I got into the meat of the pitch. I described scenes and big character moments, action sequences and chunks of dialogue. I went on for almost half an hour, which is way too long for a normal pitch, but somehow just about right for this one. When I finished, Stephen glanced over at Wayne Williams and quietly said, "This guy gets it." Like they were confirming something or reflecting on an earlier conversation. Then he turned to me and said, "That was terrific. You did an excellent pitch. You're a very good storyteller. Not everyone is." Then, for the next 10 or 15 minutes, we all talked casually, almost like colleagues, as he tweaked certain moments in the pitch and made small adjustments. And as I was sitting there, I was trying to take in the reality that my hero and I were already collaborating, tossing ideas back and forth. For a few minutes, on Wednesday, May 22nd, 1996, my dream life and my real life met and fused together and became a single glowing object. As the meeting ended and we all stood up to go, Wayne, almost offhand, said to Stephen, "So I'll go ahead and set up the pitch with Universal." Now, what he was really saying was, "Are you approving Richard as the writer you want to move forward with on the A-Team movie? Is this the guy we're bringing into Universal to do the pitch again and seal the deal? Do we have a yes in the room from you?" He said it quick, like it was a foregone conclusion, but I knew exactly what he was doing. And a cold blast of fear went through me when Stephen said no. And time stopped, and a lifespan of sadness and disappointment and misery played out in its entirety before he said, "I'll do it. I'm having lunch with Stuart anyway." So there it was, the yes in the room. Finally, when it really mattered. 13 years later, but just in time. 15 minutes later, I found myself back in the underground parking lot, thinking back to the day in October of 1983, when Larry and I drove off after meeting Stephen J. Cannell the first time, and me feeling like my career was finally starting. I felt that way now too. Maybe this time, I'd be right.
Cannon Beach, Oregon. The phantom of a man completely wrapped in bandages haunts the small community. The bloody figure, smelling of rotting flesh, jumps into vehicles, passing on a road outside of town. Bandage Man has appeared in pickup trucks, sedans, station wagons, and even sports cars. Sometimes he breaks windows or leaves behind bits of foul-smelling bandages. Some believe he is the ghost of a dead logger cut to pieces in a sawmill accident.
Michelle came home the next day and went on total bed rest, which meant I had to take an official leave of absence from Tony Roma's. Now, for the moment at least, Michelle and I had absolutely no income whatsoever. But I wasn't worried, because Stephen Cannell had loved my pitch. Sure, I still had to pitch it to Universal, but somehow, that felt like no more than a formality. A few days later, Wayne showed up at my house, carrying a huge box. "What's that?" I said. "A fax machine," he said. "You bought me a fax machine? You have to have one so you can send us pages," he said. Keep in mind, I wasn't even officially hired yet, but here was Wayne Williams buying me a $400 fax machine with Stephen Cannell's money. "I know what you're thinking," he said, "but the Universal pitch is just a formality. You're definitely getting the job. Trust me."
Bishopville, South Carolina. In June 1988, the first encounter with South Carolina's Lizard Man occurred here. While changing a tire on a road that runs through the dismal bog, Christopher Davis was approached by a red-eyed, greenish-black, reptilian creature that stood over 7 feet tall. A farmer's sighting in Brownsville became the most publicized encounter, but dozens of people eventually reported seeing the beast. A thorough investigation by police and news media from around the country failed to explain the sightings.
Randy Press, my debt collector from Washington Mutual, called me every few days. I got into the habit of telling him what was going on with the A-Team movie. He remained shockingly uninterested, but at the same time, he let me talk. I told him about Wayne Williams and the fax machine. I told him about Stephen Cannell and the Frangelico and the big meeting coming up at Universal Studios. These were good stories. We should be having a better time. But we weren't. Not really. My pitch to Universal was on Thursday, June 6th. And once again, Wayne Williams' instincts were dead on. The pitch went great, and we got another yes in the room. It had been pretty much just a formality. Later that afternoon, my agent David Saunders called to tell me I had been officially approved by Universal, and now it was just a matter of getting the deal done. But instead of congratulating me, he sounded strangely subdued. I asked him if something was wrong, and he said, "I don't want to worry you, but getting a yes this quickly isn't necessarily good news." What the fuck was he talking about? David said that the deal may not close at all, because it was an open secret all over town that Universal was having money troubles and may not want to invest into some giant money sucker of a movie right now. The rumor was that they may be tightening their belts in an act of fiscal responsibility. He said, "They said a fast yes to keep Cannell happy. Now if the deal doesn't go through, they can blame business affairs." I can't quite believe what I'm hearing. I did a great pitch that Stephen Kennell loved. Then I did it again for the executives at Universal, and they loved it too. And I still might not get the job? David tells me not to panic. The deal could still happen. He says he's going to be very aggressive, but he adds, don't expect a big payday. Randy Press continues to leave messages, but now I don't bother to call him back. Why waste my stories on him? Let him torture his other deadbeats. Fuck that dude. The next day, I get an offer from Citibank. Would I like to transfer $5,000 at 0% for up to 6 months? Why, yes, I believe I would. That would at least get Randy off my back. But I decide to wait. Instead of throwing the letter into recycling, I put it in the files with the rest of the credit card bills. Just in case. Wednesday, June 19th, was Michelle's final day on her anti-contraction meds. Dr. Franklin said she was now in the safe zone. Owen's lungs were developed enough so that if he was born right now, he'd be healthy. He also said she could go off bed rest. We'd been cooped up almost a month, and we were both going a little crazy. And even though I knew we couldn't afford it and shouldn't do it, I found one credit card that still had a pulse, and we decided to eat dinner out. We drove all the way to San Pedro to a place we knew called the Sixth Street Bistro. I just wanted to sit in the sun and feel good for a little while. I hadn't told Michelle about the calls from Randy Press. I hadn't told her about the mounting credit card debt either. I pretended it was because I didn't want to worry her in her delicate state, but the real reasons were more complicated. I hadn't told her because I felt that the debt was a problem I should solve on my own, before she even knew it was a problem. And then later, when I realized exactly how bad it was, how unable I was to solve it, I didn't tell her because I was afraid. Afraid that she would be mad. Afraid of admitting that I'd let her and us down. Afraid that she would be afraid. Afraid that she would have an opinion about what we should do, and that would rob me of some kind of control. And if I lost the belief that I had magical control over the events in my life and what happened to me, I felt like I would dissolve into nothingness. So I didn't tell her. Instead, this night, we talked about Owen. And on that day, June 20th, 1996, I think I still believed that somehow Owen would also be a thing I could control. We talked about his future, which was also our future. How old we would be when he started high school. How old we would be when he started college or got married. It was hard to imagine being 40 or 50. At the time, it seemed very old. She's going to have a baby, I thought. How is she not scared? She is giving herself over to the reality that things will be what they will be. And she's been doing it for a long time now, without complaint or panic. As if she understands that sometimes events unfold according to forces outside of ourselves, outside of our conscious desires. And maybe that is the real magic.
Chattanooga, Tennessee. Old Green Eyes is the name of a demon who hides in the bushes of the Chickamauga Chattanooga Military Park. This humanoid creature has glowing green-orange eyes with fang-like teeth. It wears a cape, which is partially hidden by its waist-length hair. The ghoul was first seen prowling among the corpses after Civil War battles. In the 1970s, it caused two separate automobile accidents when it was spotted alongside a road.
My whole life changed 6 hours later. I woke up at 4 a.m. and saw that Michelle was out of bed. She was at the closet going through her hospital go bag, the one we had just packed yesterday. She was having pains, but they weren't too bad and they weren't too often. She told me to go back to sleep. And you guys, I did. When I woke up again at 6, she told me it was time to go to the hospital. She wasn't scared, so I decided I wasn't scared. By the time we got to the hospital, the contractions were 2 to 3 minutes apart and were lasting about 50 seconds each. For me, the next 8 hours were a rippling blur of fear and waiting and excitement and exhaustion and exhilaration. Things were happening. Things were moving forward. We were going to meet Owen today. We were not totally in control anymore, if we ever were, but we were at a hospital, so I felt like we were at least safe. The nurses were monitoring Michelle by the minute. Ron and Barbara showed up, and so did my parents, and my brother, and her sister. And I kept a running journal of everything that happened that day, and the exact time it happened. Which is why I can tell you that Owen was born at exactly 3:15 p.m. on June 21st, 1996, the first day of summer, and also the longest day of the year. I was there, I saw the whole thing, and anyone who tells you that childbirth is a beautiful thing is lying. Or maybe they're talking in the abstract, like, it's nice when new people are born, and not, a weird mucus-covered worm just came out of my wife's vagina. We each held him for a little while, and we both had the distinct feeling that he was his own person. Already, instantly. It was going to take some time to bond, to really meet him. That was 29 years ago. The process is ongoing. Michelle's sister brought us dinner that night. Penne all'arrabbiata, and garlic bread, and red wine, and we ate it right there in the hospital room. I called David Saunders to let him know what had happened. He answered the phone and surprised me with a loud, "Congratulations!" I said, "How did you know?" And he said, "Because I'm the one who made it happen." That was odd. I was almost sure it was me. "What are you talking about?" I said. That's when he told me that he had closed the A-team deal that afternoon at 3:15 for more than twice what he thought it would close at. $225,000. I couldn't believe it. It was more than I expected, more than I ever could have hoped for. It was magic. Everything was. I felt like an incredibly long drought had suddenly come to an end with a deluge of rain, and I was dancing in it. I wanted to call Randy Press. He'd be so happy for me. I thanked David Saunders as profusely as I could, and then we hung up. I looked over at Michelle, holding Owen. I wanted to tell her about the money, but I decided this was news that could wait. I looked out the window, to the east, across the San Gabriel Valley, where the sky was just beginning to turn from yellow and green to dark blue. Just beyond that dim horizon, the whole country, mile after mile, was filled with ghosts. Ghosts and Bigfoots and demons and lizard men stretching thousands of miles into the distance. And everything that could not be seen by day and everything that only shone at night rose up and winked and smiled and bowed at the human miracle that had occurred and gave their silent, strange, ominous blessing and seemed to whisper into the twilight sky, "We welcome you, Owen. We've been waiting for you. We will see you in time." All I could think was, I love it when a plan comes together. Later that night, I sat with Owen in my arms.
He was so small and so cute now that he was cleaned up and all. And he stared up at me with his bright blue eyes so full of insistent vitality and curiosity and impatience and accusation. "Take it easy," I told him. "You don't have to do anything yet. You've done a lot today. You've done enough." 8 months ago, Michelle's mother, Barbara, had told me, "A baby brings his own basket." I had wanted to believe her, but I didn't. Not really. But he had. And such a basket. Maybe we should have more babies right away. "Thank you, Owen," I said. "I don't know what you've got planned next, but I can't wait to find out." He looked up at me and started to cry. I immediately moved to hand him off to someone. But then I realized with clarity and a little fear, he's mine. I need to comfort him. He'd been fed, and he couldn't possibly be hungry. So instead, I just stood and began walking around the room with him, always taking time to stop by the window where the world grew darker by the minute. "Owen, there's this house in Michigan where the ghosts live at the top of the stairs, and a ghost train in Belleville, Texas. And there's a Toys R Us in Sunnyvale, California, where at night the toys leap off the shelves and play all by themselves. It's true, Owen. It's true. I know it sounds like magic, but it's all true. One day I'll show you. Trust me." And after a while, he calmed down and closed his bright blue eyes and drifted off to sleep. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as I crack open, quite literally, the scariest book I've ever read, The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.